Hey guys, I hope everyone is doing absolutely fantastic on this beautiful January day. All right, I'm going to jump right into updates. So, number one, Happy New Year! Goodbye 2020, hello 2021. Raise your hand high in the back if you're ready for a do-over, huh? Geez, what a crazy year. So I mean this from the absolute bottom of my heart. I genuinely wish each and every one of you a happy, healthy, and prosperous 2021. Okay, number two. Did you hear that? I cannot believe I almost, well, not almost, don't tell anybody, but I just got a tiny bit choked up when I said that. Oh my goodness. Okay, I'm over it. I'm good. Good. Game face. Number two, as you all know, I post a lot on TikTok. Well, as of last night, I noticed that the hashtag of Crime Time Tea Time just hit 5 million views. I'm so, so excited. So thank you all so much for helping to make that happen. I really, really, really appreciate it. And if you're not on TikTok, that's okay too. So I also post videos on YouTube and Instagram as well. I hardly have any followers on Instagram, but it's the exact same content. I have even less subscribers on YouTube, and I'm laughing because I checked yesterday and I legit have 33. So my son, who is 11, has more YouTube subscribers than I do. Anyways, check it out. Subscribe if you would like. I would certainly appreciate it. So it's different than podcasts. It's a lot shorter. So podcasts are, you know, 30 to 45 minutes. These are just little three. Well, some of them are only a minute. So they're anywhere from 1 to 5 minute videos on different true crime stories. Or there's like series. There's a Last Words of Convicted Killers, Last Meals of Convicted Killers, World's Dumbest Criminals, just things like that. So anyhow, check it out when you get a chance. It's all the same. Crime Time, Tea Time. You can either put spaces in between it or you can do all one word. I checked both ways on all platforms. You will find it. Okay. On to the main event. The reason you all are here today. So today's story is interesting because it's the first story within its category that I have ever done. So I don't want to give away too much upfront info. So for now, let's just leave it at that. But you will see what I mean soon. Okay, guys, you know what time it is. If and only if you are ready for a mind-blowing ride, sit back and buckle up. Because this is the story of the List family murders. Okay, so I'm going to start off this story by telling you about a man named John List. John List was a man who, by any stretch of the imagination, seemingly had it all. A loving wife, three beautiful children, and a mother who lived with them and was still very actively engaged in their lives. On top of that, he had served his country enlisting in the army in 1943. If that wasn't enough, he graduated from the University of Michigan, earning his bachelor's degree in business administration. He then went on to get his master's in accounting. From the outside looking in, it was safe to say life was going very well for Mr. John List. Just to put a cherry on top, he was the Sunday school teacher at their Lutheran church. Like, of course he was, right? And if things couldn't seem to get any better for this man, they were about to. In 1965, John accepted a position as the vice president at a bank in Jersey City, New Jersey. He was making such good money in this new position that he was able to move his family to 431 Hillside Avenue in Westfield, New Jersey. It is honorable for anyone, man or woman, to purchase a home. But this was nothing short of magnificent. 431 Hillside Avenue also known as Breeze Knoll, was a Victorian-style 19-bedroom mansion that had this beautiful original Tiffany stained glass. And can we just say, by the way, that if your house has a name that people in the community refer to it by, your house is badass. You know what I mean? Like, no questions asked, hands down. If your house has a name besides its USPS address, you're a baller. And I'm referring to the fact that this was called Breeze Knoll. And yes, it's important that I say it that way for no other reason except, I don't know, it sounds fun. Okay, so for a few years, things seemed to be going pretty darn good. But as we all know, looks can be deceiving. There were a few things going on behind the scenes that the family had not shared. For one, Helen, who was John's wife, had contracted syphilis from her first husband, who had died at war, by the way. In later stages, syphilis can cause a lot of negative side effects, such as tiredness, headaches, nervous system issues, joint pain, fever, insanity, and paralysis. I can't say it was solely because of this diagnosis, but this, along with some possible mental illness, Helen had become heavily dependent on alcohol and tranquilizers. I can never say that word. I was hoping so bad I would get that out. Tranquilizers. Thank you. To cope with her diagnosis and life in general. I'm usually very overprotective of victims in any case, but you should know the truth. I'm not sure if it's because of the alcohol use, if she didn't like John, or if it was truly just her personality. But apparently, on more than one occasion, Helen shouted out at some public function that her first husband, the one that had passed away at war, was more well-endowed than John and better in bed. And I guess, like, shouted it for everyone to hear. Helen, that is inappropriate. Here's the thing, though, and I'm going to say this as slow as possible so the folks in the back can hear me. Every family has issues, right? No one is perfect. Okay, let's fast forward a few years. The day is Tuesday, November 9th, 1971. There was absolutely nothing exciting about the way this day started. The same, however, could not be said about the way Tuesday, November 9th, 1971 ended. The family woke up and began their day as usual. Helen got up, got the kiddos, you know, awake, dressed, fed, and ready for school. John woke up, dressed himself, prepared for work. The children got on the bus and off to school they went. Following right behind, John got into his car and left for work. Helen, presumably taking a minute of downtime to herself after getting her husband and three kids prepared for their productive days, poured herself a hot cup of coffee and sat down at the kitchen table. Just then, as she was enjoying probably those first few sips, someone opened the front door to her home, and before she could even turn around, shot her in the back of the head. Just that quickly, a wife and mother of three was dead. John's mother, 84-year-old Alba List, was living with the family. Unfortunately, she was next in line to meet the same fate as her daughter-in-law. Alba was shot in the front of the head, though, through the left eye. Unlike Helen, Alba saw her attacker. She would have stared this person in the eye that pulled the trigger of the gun that took her life. After this monster shot and killed both of the adult women that lived in the house, this sicko helped himself to their refrigerator, made himself something to eat, and waited. Think about that. This murderer sat in a house with two dead females for hours, waiting on three innocent kids to walk through the same door. Right on time, the front door of 431 Hillside Avenue flew open, and two of the family's three kids arrived home. 16-year-old Patricia and 13-year-old Frederick arrived home from school. The attacker wasted no time, shooting both kids in the back of the head. Thankfully, John and Helen's oldest son, who was the middle child, John Jr., was playing in a soccer game that day. His dad was able to watch the game. After the soccer game, John and John Jr. headed home. Once the pair got home, they walked into an absolute nightmare. Poor John Jr. Can you imagine walking through your front door and witnessing the horror of seeing your mom, your grandma, and your two siblings all shot in the head nonetheless? As he was trying to understand and process the scene, the worst possible outcome happened. The person that had taken the lives of his entire family was now pointing the gun at him. Imagine how scary that must have been for John Jr. Now, take that same image in your head, that image of the person pointing that gun at him, and imagine it's your own father, John List Sr. Yes, you heard me right. 46-year-old John List Sr. was the monster responsible for taking out his entire family. Talk about a plot twist, huh? The one difference in John Jr.'s murder is this. There were a few. The first was the fact that the rest of the family suffered from a single gunshot wound to the head. John Jr. was shot multiple times and was shot outside the head. It is widely accepted that John Jr. fought for his life. He fought his dad and tried to save his own life. As a result, John Sr. misfired several times. Unfortunately, though, little John Jr. was no match for his father, who was carrying a 9mm semi-automatic handgun and a Colt 22. After he took the lives of his entire family, 46-year-old John List put the bodies of his family in sleeping bags, laid them side by side, and placed them in the mansion's ballroom. For some reason, John's mom, Alba, was found in a separate area of the house. Now, this is kind of like a sidebar. I could not find a reason why that was, but I posted a little TikTok on this story, and a woman who follows me on TikTok actually sent me a message saying that John left his mom in the other room because he couldn't move her, physically. He couldn't carry her into the ballroom. So I don't know that for certain or, you know, for fact, but it does make sense. So I don't know. It's definitely a possibility. John Sr. then cleaned up the crime scene and left. Before leaving the house, though, John did a few things. First, he wrote a 5-page letter to his pastor. Second, he went around the house and cut his face out of any picture that he was in. Third, he turned down the thermostat as low as it would go. Fourth, he turned on the radio to play throughout the mansion's intercom system. Now, I've heard two things. I've heard classical music, and I've also heard the Christian radio station. So I'm not sure which one. I've read from two very reliable sources, opposite. So I'm not sure. But regardless, he was playing some type of music or radio station through the mansion's intercom system. He also turned all the lights in the house on. So after he kills his wife and mom, but before the kids got home, John also tied up some potential loose ends. One, he called the kids' school to let them know that they would be visiting Helen's mom in North Carolina for a few weeks. Of course, this was a lie, but he used it as an excuse as to why the kids wouldn't be at school. He figured this would help limit suspicion and give him more of a head start. Of course, there were never any plans for that to happen. Actually, it was the opposite. It was the other way around. Helen's mom was supposed to come up for a visit. She backed out at the last minute, though, because she had gotten sick. And tell me how crazy this is. John later admitted, like years and years and years later, that had Helen's mom come up to New Jersey, she would have been his sixth victim that day. Okay. Anyways, calling the kids' school was the first thing he did. The second thing John did was go to the bank and close out all of his accounts as well as his mom's account. The third thing he did was call both the newspaper company and the milkman and ask them to stop delivery since they would be, quote, out of town for the next few weeks. Although John committed the murders on November 9th, the bodies were not discovered until December 7th. And in case math isn't your thing, that is 28 days of waiting. I absolutely hate to say it, and it's not, you know, I'm not giving him a solid, but John did a pretty good job of preparing. Finally, after almost 4 weeks, suspicions started to grow. I've read this two ways on who to credit with calling police. So I've read that one of the kids' teachers is who originally called the police. And then I've also read in another reliable source that it was actually the neighbors that called the police. But I guess whatever, it doesn't matter. The point is that someone called the police finally. And remember, John had left all the lights in the house on. So the light bulbs were actually starting to burn out because they'd been running or, you know, on for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 28 days. So the lights started burning out. And I guess that's what eventually caught, you know, raised suspicion, I should say. So anyway, all right, so here's a crazy little detail. When police first arrived, they did a perimeter search and found nothing really suspicious. So they left. I couldn't believe it. They left. Later that night, we know for certain that Patricia's drama teacher called and said whatever the 1971 version of WTF to the cops, and they came back to the house. It was the same teacher that finally convinced the cops to enter the house through an unlocked window. Needless to say, they found what they were looking for. It didn't take police that long at all to realize who had done this. Pretty much process of elimination. We have six family members, five of them are dead, and one of them is gone. You know what I mean? A nationwide manhunt for John List ensued. Police investigated hundreds of tips, but hit roadblock after roadblock. They were able to locate the family's vehicle at JFK Airport in New York City, but they were unable to confirm if John had actually boarded a flight or not. Don't forget, too, that John had destroyed all the pictures of himself before he left, so police had no reliable pictures of John to circulate. And that comment has to be so crazy to hear for any young listeners. Unless you grew up without the internet, I don't think you can really understand just how different things were. So I'm 38. We got the internet when I was a sophomore in high school. So I can't claim to have grown up completely without the internet. But even back then, think about how we would upload pictures. It wasn't on a cell phone through Wi-Fi. We would take a picture on an actual camera and then use a cord that connected from the camera to the computer and download or upload. I still don't know what the difference between those two are, but whatever. Download or upload the pictures onto the computer, right? Oh, how things have changed. Anyways, the point to take from this is that not having a picture of John made the job of finding John very difficult. So the house remained vacant for 9 months. It's not uncommon for death houses or houses that murders took place in to be destroyed. And 431 Hillside Avenue was no different. 9 months after the murder, so in August, the home burned to the ground. You guys, police looked for this freaking monster for 18 years. Finally, In May of 1989, everyone's favorite show in the late 80s, America's Most Wanted, aired an episode about the tragedy. The episode showed an age-progressed clay sculpture of what John would have looked like. You know what I mean? Like what they were assuming he would have looked like 18 years later. Now, stop and think about that for a minute. Seriously, let's recap this. The FBI hires a forensic artist named Frank Bender. Honestly, this guy draws out on paper what John looked like 18 years prior based on descriptions from what people told him, right? Because remember, they don't have any pictures of the guy. He then takes this sketch and out of freaking clay does an age progression on him that someone actually recognized. I mean, damn, right? You know how they say, especially given the time we're going through right now, that not all heroes wear capes? I believe Mr. Frank Bender qualifies under that heading. That is absolute skill and talent right there. Anyway, I don't know if Mr. Frank Bender is still alive or not, but Mr. Frank Bender, if you're out there and by some absolute miracle hear this, I want you to know that you are a total badass. Okay, anyways, 2 weeks later, on June 1st, police arrest John at the accounting firm he worked at in Richmond. Awkward. One of his previous neighbors from Denver happened to be watching the show that night and called in the tip. Talk about the stars aligning, huh? It is seriously almost unreal to think about how all the pieces of this puzzle fit together to make this happen. For months, 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 John stuck to his alias, which was Bob Clark. He denied being John List. Finally, on February 16th, 1990, John List broke down and admitted to authorities who he really was. Not because of the guilt, you know, not that guilt caught up with him and he felt like he needed to own it. No. The cops presented irrefutable evidence to John, including fingerprints that matched and other evidence that matched the crime scene. I wasn't able to find out exactly what that other evidence was, but I don't know. All they said was other evidence, which was a bummer because I wanted to hear exactly what they found. But I personally could not find anything. Anyhow, at his trial, John List said that he had been laid off from his job. Instead of just telling his family the truth, he decided to lie because he didn't want to be, quote unquote, embarrassed. So every single morning, he would wake up and get dressed. He would then drive to the train station and spend the day there, reading the newspaper and or taking naps. Once the time came, he would pack up all of his stuff and go home. Can you imagine? Of course, he now had no income because he wasn't working. So since his bills were mounting up, he did what any respectable man would do. He stole it from his 84-year-old mom. Skimming money from her account helped to avoid the house being foreclosed on, but even that wasn't enough. He then told his kids that they needed to find part-time jobs to teach them the value of working hard. In all actuality, though, he was taking that money from them, too. Of course, the few bucks these kids were probably making wasn't enough to pay the bills of this 19-bedroom mansion, so the financial pressures continued to get worse and worse. It makes you think, though, how interesting the relationship between John and Helen must have been. You know what I mean? Like, this was back then. It wasn't today where young people get married and keep separate accounts. Like, that's very common. Honestly, Michael and I don't even think we got a joint account until we moved. And then the only reason we did is just because it would be easier to open one instead of two. So I know that that's common now. But back then, that was not common at all. So anyways, John must have been running a pretty tight ship, though, for his wife to not question, like, hey, how come the creditors are calling? Why are the creditors sending mail for late payments? Things like this. So I often wonder if Helen knew how much trouble they were in, or, you know, if she truly just had no part of the household responsibility. I don't know. Anyway, okay. So John felt like he had two ways to deal with the situation he was in. One, he could accept welfare. Or two, he could kill his family and send their souls to heaven. If he accepted welfare, he would live with the shame and embarrassment. But if he killed his family, they would go to heaven and live an eternal life with God. This is what he was thinking, guys. When asked why he didn't commit suicide afterwards, because in a situation like this, a family annihilator typically, not always, typically will end their life after they take the lives of their family. But in this case, he obviously did not. And he said it was because he didn't think he would go to heaven if he had killed himself, and he hoped to be reunited with his family one day. So, it was okay to end all of their lives, but when it's time to end your own, you know, there's now some type of a compass we're trying to follow, huh? Like, oh my gosh, that annoyed me and just frustrated me so badly. But anyway, okay. So, in custody and at trial, John begins to give answers of how he got away with this for so long. He said, after the murders, he took a train from New Jersey to Michigan. He then traveled from Michigan to Colorado. He ended up settling down in Denver in 1972, and he took an accounting job. He used the name of one of his college classmates, Robert Peter Clark, and he decided to go by the nickname of Bob. Interestingly enough, though, when the FBI found and interviewed the real Robert Peter Clark, he swears up and down he has never met John List before. So I don't know. Obviously one of them's lying. I have no idea why the real Robert Peter Clark would want to lie. But it is just another weird twist in the story. Okay. So from 1979 to 1986, John worked as a controller for a paper box manufacturer outside of Denver. Being deeply rooted, God-fearing Lutheran that he was, he joined the local congregation in Denver for a church. There he met a woman named Dolores Miller, who in 1985 became John's second wife. A few short years later, they moved to, I think it's Midlothian, Virginia. On April 12th, 1990, John List was convicted of five counts of first degree murder. He was sentenced to five life terms to be served consecutively without the possibility of parole. At the time, this was the maximum penalty. He was given a chance to speak, and then, 18 years later, he still would not take responsibility for what happened to his family. He said, quote, I feel that because of my mental state at the time, I was unaccountable for what happened. I ask all affected for their forgiveness, understanding, and prayer. End quote. The judge looked right back at him, dead in the eye, and said, quote, John, you are a man without remorse and without honor. After 18 years, 5 months, and 22 days, it is now time for the voices of Helen, Alma, Patricia, Frederick, and John List to rise from the grave. End quote. That was pretty powerful when I heard that. Okay, so are you ready for the craziest twist you'll ever hear, though? Investigators learned that there was a piece of stained glass in the mansion, which was an original Tiffany. By itself, it was estimated to be worth $100,000 at the time. The equivalence to this or to that today is just under $700,000. How is that for awkward? I often think about what John's response was after he must have heard that news. If lack of money really was the only motivator for killing his family. And then to find out there were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars literally under your nose or in front of your nose. Wow. 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 Not sure if I could live with myself after hearing that. Anyways, in an interview John gave in 2002, he finally expressed the faintest, slightest bit of remorse when he said, quote, "I wish I had never done what I did. I've regretted my action and prayed for forgiveness ever since," end quote. On March 21st, 2008, at age 82, John List died from complications of pneumonia at St. Francis Medical Center while still under prison custody in Trenton, New Jersey. All right, guys. Well, that wraps up today's episode. I hope you guys have a, let's see, today's Friday, so I hope you have an awesome, awesome weekend. Enjoy it. Spend some time with your family. Hopefully you don't have to work. And catch up on some good movies. All right, guys. Take care. Bye.